Well, it is very good to see everybody here this morning. It's good to be back from our trip to Dallas. It was a good long drive there and a much, much longer drive home. But it's very good to be home. I hope that you all enjoyed your Thanksgiving week as much as we did, that you got to spend it with friends and family, that you got to enjoy some time off from work. And if it was not the ideal week for you, then I do pray that this Sunday is the beginning of a better week for you. Let's have our Bibles open to Numbers chapter 16. That's where we're going to be looking first. Numbers chapter 16, and we're going to talk briefly about Korah and his rebellion that he led. We're not going to do the entire story because I want to take one part of this story and make some applications about it as we move forward. But have your Bibles open to Numbers chapter 16 and verse 1. There is an old saying about fools rushing in where angels fear to tread. What that saying is essentially meaning is that there are places and things, there are events and scenarios where even angels, with all of their power and glory, will say, I ain't going there. But the fool will look at that situation, he'll be the first one to line up for it. Whether it's daredevil activities or risky business investments, whatever it is, there are places where angels fear to tread, but fools are willing to rush in. I want to give you two examples of fools rushing in from the Old Testament, and then I want to spend the rest of our lesson talking about the difference between being impetuous in spirit and being courageous as God actually defines courage. So we'll begin here in Numbers chapter 16 and verse 1. And we'll read through verse 3 for now. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took action. Take special note of that phrase, that they took action. We're going to look at that here in just a moment. Verse 2. And they rose up before Moses together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation chosen in the assembly, men of renown. And they assembled together against Moses and Aaron and spoke to them. You have gone far enough, they said, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? Pick up here in verse 4. When Moses heard this, he fell on his face and he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy and will bring him near to himself, even the one whom he will choose. He will bring near to himself. Do this. This is Moses' suggestion. Do this. Take censers for yourselves, Korah and all your company, and put fire in them and lay incense upon them in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. You have gone far enough, you sons of Levi. And I love the way that he takes Korah's own language in verse 3 and turns it around on him. Now, we don't need to look at the rest of the story in great detail because that's not the point that I want to make from this story. But as you know, Korah and Moses essentially are challenged to take these censers of incense and present them to God. What Korah's argument is, if you're not really familiar with this, what Korah's argument is, why is there such a separation between you and the rest of us? Why is it that Moses and Aaron have their own little special club and God talks to them and interacts with them and treats them in a way that seems different than all the rest of us? What makes Moses and Aaron so special that we don't get to do all of the things that they get to do? We don't get to enter into the inner sanctum of the tabernacle. We don't get to offer the incense the way that the priests do. We don't get to speak face to face to God the way that Moses does. Why do Moses and Aaron have their own special little club in the company of Israel and all the rest of us are chopped liver? So what Korah wants is the opportunity to serve and to work and to worship in a way that he wants rather than the way that God has defined. Moses is taken aback by this and simply says, Well, let's just see who God actually does choose. And Moses isn't being rude here. Remember, he was the one who was accused. He's the victim here. It's Korah who's being impetuous. And Moses simply says, all right, we'll take censers of incense. And we'll show up tomorrow and we'll offer our incense to God and we'll see who God is actually pleased with. And if you know how the story goes, then you know it doesn't work out very well for Korah and his companions. But let's look at a few details from these first few verses about the impetuous nature of Korah and those who were with him. First of all, they took action. That phrase there in verse 1, that they took action. You know, sometimes it's tempting when nothing is happening to just make something happen for yourself. When it feels like nothing's going on, the leadership is not making decisions, nobody is taking initiative, the temptation, and it's not always a bad thing, but the temptation is to take the initiative for yourself. No one else is taking action, so I should. But we need to be really careful about that. Because sometimes when we take action like Korah and his companions did, the action that we take is irrational. The action that we take is sometimes based on passion or anger or frustration. And the action that we take is sometimes against or contrary to God's will. Consider a couple of practical applications here. The big danger when nothing is happening is to make something happen. And sometimes nothing happening can be a good thing. When things are running smoothly, when there is no drama, don't manufacture drama for yourself. There are some people who find peace in a congregation, or peace in a family, or peace in a business so uncomfortable that they have to manufacture drama for themselves. Sometimes when you think nothing is happening, that's just a sign that everything is going smoothly. Unhappy husbands do this by looking for fulfillment in extramarital relationships. They feel like nothing's happening, so they take action. Children do this when they become impatient about birthday presents and Christmas presents, and they go looking for them in their parents' closets. Christians do this when they become impatient about how slowly prayers are being answered. They take matters into their own hands instead of trusting in God. Sometimes we need to understand that God takes time, and the way that he wants to do something may not please us in the short term. Korah, for example, believed that he had the right to bowl ahead and take initiative where it was not called for. So again, in verse 2, that they rose up before Moses together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders chosen in the assembly, men of renown. Great practical application. Is God impressed with men of renown? Think about that. Is God impressed with men of renown if the action that you're taking is impetuous and unlawful? So Korah shows up with men of renown, leaders in the assembly, 250 of them. These guys are civic leaders and business leaders. These are knowledgeable, the educated, the elite. These are the intellectuals. These are the courageous. These are the warriors. These are men of renown. Do you think God has gone like, oh, I didn't realize you were there. Oh, I'm sorry, Korah. I didn't realize it. I didn't realize you had that much on your resume. Is God impressed with men of renown when men of renown are acting in an unlawful manner? It doesn't matter what your reputation is. It doesn't matter how rich you are or how powerful you are. Being a man or woman of renown does not give you permission to act impetuously before the throne of God. So they were men of renown. And they died a death of the sinner the next day. When they intruded upon God's holiness, God didn't care just how special they were, or how elite they were, or what they thought of themselves. You have gone far enough, they said to Moses. You know, I wonder, who really went far enough there? You have gone far enough. Do we sometimes think that about the elders? You have gone far enough, dictating to us, telling us, instructing us, or rebuking us. To the preacher, you've gone far enough preaching sermons that make us uncomfortable, stepping on toes, touching on a taboo subject that we'd rather not hear about. You've gone far enough. I don't want to hear about pornography from the pulpit. I don't want to hear about molestation from the pulpit. I don't want to hear about broken marriages from the pulpit, or spousal abuse from the pulpit, or laziness, or gluttony from the pulpit. You've gone far enough. You've gone far enough, oh spouse, calling me on it when I'm living a hypocritical life. Or telling me that I need to spend more time with the kids. Or telling me that I need to help more. Or telling me that I have a gambling problem. You've gone far enough. You've gone far enough, young man or young woman, correcting me just because you're younger than me. You've gone far enough. Who really went far enough? Was it Moses, who was simply following God's commandments, living in the way and prophesying in the way and giving the law in the way that God had dictated to him? Or was it Korah, who looked at the holiness of God in the sanctuary of God before the prophet of God and said, "You're nothing special, Moses and Aaron"? Who really went far enough? And again, that's why I love it when Moses turns the language around on him in verse 7. No, it's you who've gone far enough, you sons of Levi. You're the ones who have gone far enough. For all the congregation are holy. That's Korah's response. That's Korah's explanation. And that might sound like a good reason to reject Moses and Aaron's authority. But it is purely that. A human reason. So that's one example of the impetuous heart. Let's look at another. Please turn to 1 Samuel chapter 13 now. In 1 Samuel chapter 13. And we're going to notice the story here of Saul's impetuous heart. So we find out some things beginning in verse 1 that Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 32 years over Israel. And Saul collected for himself 3,000 men of Israel. These were special elite soldiers that were kind of his personal guard. We find some things out about Jonathan, his son, in verse 3 and the interaction that they had. We find out some of their exploits in fighting against the Philistines in verse 5. Let's pick up here now in verse 6. So when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves, in thickets, in cliffs, in cellars, and in pits. So with the Philistines pressing down upon them, what's the people's response? It's not courage, that's for sure. It's tuck, tail, and run. It's find the best hiding place that you can and get out of the way. Also, some of the Hebrews in verse 7 crossed the Jordan in the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him, trembling. So this is a bad situation for Saul, is basically what we're saying. He's only just become king very recently. He's only had some success militarily. Remember, at this time, Israel still did not see itself as a very unified nation. Yes, Saul was king, but that doesn't mean that everybody in Israel necessarily followed his orders. This was still a very tribal, a very localized, all the power was localized. Saul did not have consolidated control over Israel. And so here he is, the new king, in a very uncomfortable, very tenuous position with the Philistines pressing down and his people fleeing. So we pick up here in verse 8. So he waited 7 days, as he was told by the prophet Samuel, by the way, according to the appointed time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings." And he offered the burnt offering. And it came about, as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, that behold, Samuel came. Isn't that interesting how things work out like that? Just as soon as he finished offering the offering, who showed up? On the seventh day, just as he said that he would, who showed up? Samuel. Well, you're not going to get away with that one, Saul. The smell of the offering still heavy on the air. You're not going to get away with that one, Saul. Let's pick up here. In verse 10, it says at the end, Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. Look what I did, Samuel. Verse 11, but Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself, and I offered the burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, but you commanded you, for now the Lord would have established you and your kingdom forever, but now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded. Let's think about some things here. Having waited for Samuel to return, and for Samuel to do what needed to be done as far as sacrifices go, it appeared that nothing was happening. It appeared that Saul needed to take matters into his own hands, just like Korah did, just like we do sometimes. And so Saul thought to himself, and he had plenty of good reasons, didn't he? When Samuel called him out for it, Saul listed off all these reasons. He said, the people were scattering. That's a good excuse, isn't it? The people are scattering. And a good, hearty sacrifice to God will be the sort of thing that will rally around. The people were scattering, and you didn't come in the appointed time. Now, that's on you, Samuel. You said 7 days, and I waited till the seventh day when you didn't come at 7 o'clock in the morning. Now, that's on you, Samuel. And the Philistines were assembling, and I'm so scared of the Philistines because they have so many soldiers and they're so mean. Saul thought he had all of his ducks in a row. He thought he had all the excuses and all the reasons lined up perfectly. Was Samuel impressed with human reasoning, though? No, he said, you have acted foolishly. He made a grievous error in judgment by disregarding God's revealed will and Samuel's promise in favor of his reasoning. I liked how one writer put it. In World Magazine, from an article from 2005, the writer says, who will not pity Saul? Nothing was happening. The brave hero, having waited 7 days for Samuel to bless the battle of Gilgal, felt he could wait no more and slew the cultic calf for himself. We have so many excuses, don't we? So many reasons that we come up for acting impetuously. For rushing in where angels fear to tread. For making snap judgments. For coming to conclusions. We have so many reasons. And all the reasons sound so good and so logical and so reasonable in our heads as we're making the bad choice. But those reasons, they fall flat, my friends. They fall flat when you pit those reasons against God's will. So let us talk about impetuous hearts here for a few minutes. Both of the above examples illustrate what happens to a person who makes decisions impetuously. That's one of my favorite words, by the way, impetuously. They rush in, like the old saying goes, and they bring destruction upon themselves. So have I done the same things in my own life? Do I rush to judgments when I'm offended by what somebody else is saying? Do I assume the worst because I'm too quick to defend myself and my actions? Think about that. We're always so quick to defend ourselves. Well, I didn't. I didn't know. How could I have? Well, it's... I hear it from my sweet and wonderful children. But you know what? They're sweet and wonderful children, and that's okay. They're going to make excuses, and I don't blame them for it. Why do adults say things like that? Why does it cross our minds to say things like, well, I didn't do it? And I wouldn't have done it if you had told me. We like to push the blame on somebody else, don't we? And we love to be the defenders of ourselves, first and foremost. Are there Bible concepts that I take too far? I wonder things about that. Are there Bible concepts that I take too far or that I stretch too far? That I stretch beyond what their context is? I think that's acting impetuously. It's acting impetuously when I take things like Matthew 7, verse 1, judge not lest you be judged, and I throw it in somebody's face and say, don't judge me. That's acting impetuously. It's impetuous to take Romans chapter 14 and just make it a catch-all for everything that I want to do. You know that Romans 14 isn't about letting bygones be bygones or letting sinners commit sin. That's not what Romans 14 is about. But we love to stretch that passage to the point of breaking because we want to make it a catch-all. Do I rush in and out of romantic relationships on a whim? Think about that in your own life. Maybe before you were married, or if you're not married yet, think about that. Do you rush in and out of relationships on a whim? And do you always have, remember from the show Seinfeld back in the 90s, that there was this series of girlfriends that Jerry Seinfeld always had, and he always had these ridiculous excuses. He didn't like something about the way they talked. He didn't like that they had man hands or something like that. I mean, are you like Jerry Seinfeld and you always have like piddly little pathetic excuses for every breakup that you've had in your life? That's acting impetuously. Have I assumed the worst about another Christian because I heard gossip and I chose to believe the gossip instead of going to that Christian first and asking if it was the truth? Am I quick to argue with somebody from another religion, stubbornly pushing a point until the door for evangelism is closed? Or do I have the patience to set the whole instrumental music question to the side for now and teach someone the gospel instead of getting caught up on those kinds of questions? Am I quick to voice my opinions in Bible class and quick to defend myself when somebody more wise raises their hand and says, actually, I don't think that's true? Am I approaching the Lord's Supper with an improper heart? You can be impetuous with the Lord's Supper as well. You remember what it said in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 26 through 29, that let a man examine himself and make sure that he does not bring judgment upon himself because he's partaking in an unworthy manner. All of these are practical applications, practical examples of the impetuous heart in the life of a Christian. We act just like Korah. We act just like King Saul. Going where angels fear to tread. Rushing in with these snap judgments and foolish choices. But then there's patience. Notice the way that patience plays the ultimate role in the Christian life. Where the impetuous heart brings destruction, patience builds up and brings peace. Look at the role of patience in several passages here. In 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, it says that love is patient. Notice in James 1 and verse 19, the way that patience plays a part in our speech and in our anger and how we handle angry situations. This you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear, but slow to speak and slow to anger. And if we were patient in our anger and patient in our speech, we would save ourselves a lot of heartache. Patience in how we treat other people. Go to Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 2 and notice what it says there. With all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing forbearance to one another in love. Patience in our teaching. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 2. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 2. Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. How we approach suffering. 1 Peter 2 and verse 20. For what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. Do you have patience when it comes to suffering? I think most of us would probably agree that in the heat of the moment, in the heat of the battle, if the sword was pressed to our neck, we'd like to think that we would confess God, that we would stay true and that we'd stay faithful. We say, in that moment, I could endure that and remain faithful to God. But here's the thing. Most of our suffering doesn't come in the form of a 10-second challenge. Most of our suffering doesn't take a day to get through. Most of our suffering is long-term suffering. The challenges that come with life on planet Earth, of health difficulties and financial difficulties, of tax burdens, of relationship problems, of temptation day in and day out for an entire lifetime. It's easy to endure suffering when suffering only takes a moment. Are you patient with your suffering, though? Our attitude toward Christ's coming. You know, Christ hasn't come back yet, and it's been 2,000 years. Is he ever going to come? One might wonder. But look at James 5, verses 7 and 8. Be patient, therefore, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. Behold, the farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too, he says in verse 8. You too be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Now, that doesn't mean the coming of the Lord is soon. It means the coming of the Lord is at hand. Now, you could hold a football in your hand and you could be ready to throw a football, and it's at hand. But that doesn't mean you're going to throw it right away. You can keep a loaded gun in a holster on your side, and it's ready to go. It's loaded, it's ready. At a moment's notice, that gun can be activated. It's at hand, but that doesn't mean it's going to come right away. The coming of the Lord is at hand. You can be sure that God's finger is on the trigger. The coming of the Lord can come at any moment, and God is ready for it, and Jesus is ready for it. It's the world that has the problem. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 8. Summing up all of these things, he says, patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. And I think the haughtiness of spirit is very much the Korah, very much the Saul that we read about, very much the gossip seeker, very much the angry husband or the angry spouse, very much the greedy person, very much the impetuous heart of the person who does not trust in God in God's time. Now, the last point that I want to make is this. What about courage? Because in all this talk of patience and taking your time and fools rushing in where angels fear to tread, what about courage? Do I have to be mousy? Do I have to be spineless or gutless? Is being a Christian hiding from all of your troubles in life? God gives us a great definition of courage in Joshua 1 and verse 7. Look at what Joshua says here in Joshua 1 and verse 7. He says, only be strong and courageous. Okay, we got that part. The be strong and the courageous. Being careful to do according to all the law. I love that definition of courage because what it's saying is you can be strong and you can be brave and you can be courageous and you can be ready to meet and face every challenge that comes to you. But you've got to be careful to follow God's law. Be careful to follow God's law. Saul might have been very brave, and I don't think anybody would doubt Saul's bravery. Saul fought many battles. He killed many Philistines. He defended Israel. He was very brave. And give Saul at least some credit. He's looking at his situation there in 1 Samuel 13, and he thinks, well, I've got to do something. He might have been brave, but he wasn't courageous as God defined courage. Because according to God, courage has as much to do with being patient and waiting for God. It has as much to do with letting God be God and trusting Him. It has as much to do with being careful and deliberate about following God's laws precisely as it does rushing into something head first. Saul was brave, but he did not follow God's commandments. Therefore, he was not courageous as God defines courage. Now, we can jump to all kinds of conclusions. We can run people out of this building at the first sign of trouble. We can yell at people and scream at people. We can kick people. We can take our Bibles and whack people over the forehead with it if we want to. That doesn't mean that we're a courageous congregation. We can tear down our elders, sneak around behind their backs, get petitions signed, pass around dirty emails. We can talk about our preachers like that also. That doesn't mean that we're courageous, though. No, it means we're everything but courageous. You want to be a courageous congregation? A courage-filled church? A courage-filled Christian? A courage-filled family? Then be strong and courageous, yes. But do it according to the law of God. Keep God's authority in mind at all times. The true follower of God is not one who goes through life haphazardly. That's your other word of the day right there. He doesn't make messes. He doesn't complicate dilemmas. The true person of God does not rush to judgments, is not quick to show his temper, quick to spread around rumors. Rather, the person of God is thoughtful, often very cautious, yes, but always purposeful with what he does. His body is buffeted daily, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning in verse 24, for the purpose of self-discipline. He knows the will of the Lord not because of gut feelings or rash, outlandish conclusions, but because he has put everything to the test of Scripture. Korah started a rebellion because he took action when none was necessary. His agenda clouded his judgment, and his followers were killed because of it. King Saul rushed to do something that was profane because he felt that he was justified. He lost his kingdom because of a failure to respect the holiness of God. Jesus warns us about all of these attitudes. The attitude of the person who rushes in before he thinks through his actions in Luke chapter 14, verses 28 through 32. If you're going to build a tower, make sure you count the cost first. Don't rush into a building project unless you know you can finish it. If you're going to engage in a battle with an enemy, make sure you count your soldiers, know your strength, and know that you can actually match that enemy before you jump into the heat of battle and find yourself outgunned. Count the cost. Be thoughtful. Be deliberate. And you will discover what true courage is as God defines it. So what kind of person are you? Angels don't tread all over God's holiness. Fools do. Fools rush in. Are we the angels that respect the boundaries that God has set? Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really need to be. To be right with God, you must put yourself before His throne. To bow down before Him and confess that you believe His Son, that you're willing to be baptized for the remission of your sins, to live a faithful life for Him, to be virtuous, to be righteous, to do your best, which is all God can ever ask of any of us. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing. Will you come? Will you?